Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast.
I have a few announcements I'd like to make before we dive into today's episode. First, I wanted to let you know that if you'd prefer an ad-free experience and would also like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. That's patreon.com/psychpodcast for a completely ad-free experience and also early access to new episodes. Also, I wanted to let you know that my Transcend course is coming back in February. The next iteration of the course will offer even more ways to help you live a more fulfilling, meaningful, creative, and self-actualized life. There will only be 150 limited slots available, though, so you're going to want to save your spot as soon as possible. So you can go to transcendcourse.com to sign up. That's transcendcourse.com. Okay, now let's dive into today's episode. Today, it's great to chat with Jennifer Ocker and Naomi Bagdonis on the podcast. Jennifer is the General Atlantic Professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and a leading expert on how purpose and meaning shape individual choices and how technology can positively impact both human well-being and company growth. Her work has been widely published in lead in scientific journals and featured in The Economist, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, and Science. A recipient of the Distinguished Scientific Achievement Award and the MBA Professor of the Year, Ocker counts winning a dance-off in the early 1980s among her greatest feats. So we're going to have to talk about that one. Naomi Bagdonis is a lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and an executive coach. She helps leaders be more creative, flexible, and resilient in the face of change by facilitating interactive sessions for Fortune 100 companies and coaching executives and celebrities for appearances ranging from Saturday Night Live to The Today Show. Formerly trained at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Woohoo! I did that once. Bagdonis awesome. Performs at comedy venues and teaches improv in San Francisco's county jail. Her constant stream of foster dogs describe her as gullible and full of treats. Mm. Well, it is so delightful to have both of you on the podcast in what is going to be the most complicated bio I've ever read in the history of the Psychology Podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. No. We will take that as a compliment.
Thank you so much.
It speaks to the amazing accomplishments you both have had, and as well as your cheeky side, which I love. As you know, anyone who knows me knows that I love people who bring their whole self to the table. So let's bring our whole self, let's bring a lot of ourselves to the table today and really talk about why the world needs humor. You know, a lot of people say the world needs love, but why humor? Talk to me.
Well, okay, I will go. So
who wants to go first?
First of all, the first cut at this is humor is love in some small fashion. The end of our book, Humor Seriously, is written or sort of dialogued with Michael Lewis, who ends the book saying, when humor exists, love is not far behind. So you could say when you laugh together, you know, neurologically, you actually experience some of the same things that you experience when you actually experience love. And we can get into that if you want, but you know, that would be one way to look at it. Naomi, do you have a different way?
I would say humor has a transformational effect on our behavior and on our psychology, on our mental health, creativity, our closeness with others, and even our sense of meaning in the world. And at the same time, it's a completely under-leveraged asset at work. Our workplaces are humorless, and we think that this is going to help us get ahead. And in fact, it's absolutely not. And the third thing is that it's a learnable skill. So we think of humor as either something that you have or you don't, you're funny or you're not. But what we know is that small shifts in behavior and mindset are all it takes to reap the benefits of humor, which are particularly important in hard times.
Now, why?
Also,
yeah, go on.
Also, humor is love.
This is good. I wanted to set up a false dichotomy so you could steer me wrong. Wonderful. Well, how
do we pass, Scott? Do we pass the test? Come on.
You know, everyone has the everyone has the expression 100%. I wouldn't be like, oh, 84.3%.
Okay, well, I'm just going to bring 85.2% of my whole self to this podcast.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
No, I love it. Because, I want to be convinced. By the end of this podcast, I want you to 100% convince me that humor is love. And I think that in answering this question, I think it raises a lot of I feel like it raises even more questions, as you discuss in this book, about cancel culture, for instance. And what about, does humor have a morality component to it? What if humor is done, you know, not with love, right? What if humor is mm-hmm. there's Abraham Maslow, one of my favorite humanistic psychologists, talked about philosophical humor, you know, which is this kind of existential humor where we make fun of human existence and we're all in on the joke. All humans, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but what happens when things are really funny, but they're at the expense of a certain group or something like that? What are your thoughts on that?
Mm. Well, there are these four different, you're bringing up an important point, which is that there are obviously different styles and different aims at humor. And in general, we find that there are these four different styles. So there's the sniper, the magnet, the sweetheart, mm-hmm. and the stand-up. And each of these styles is inclined to different kinds of humor. So, so for example, what you were just describing, the kind of irreverent, ruffling feathers, maybe taking people down. That's the stand-up form of humor. These people, you know, bold, irreverent, not afraid to ruffle feathers. And what's interesting about this style of humor is it can actually build intimacy depending on your relationship. So if you have a really strong relationship with a person, then teasing can be actually really connecting. If you don't have that type of relationship, or if you have a different goal with your humor, if you're actually trying to use it to tear down an individual or group, then it can have very real downsides. You have the sweetheart, the sniper, and the magnet are the other three styles, which are less inclined to the kind that you're describing. So sweethearts, for example, earnest, honest, understated, they tend to use humor that lightens the mood.
Snipers are edgy, sarcastic, nuanced. They're sort of masters of the unexpected dig. So they're not going to be sort of out there on stage, but they're going to give you that one-liner that's a good singer. And then magnets are expressive, charismatic, really easy to make laugh. So this is the kind that's sort of most universally uplifting is the magnet. The magnet style humor.
So they, Scott, would be the least likely to offend necessarily.
Right.
And so you see these different risks associated with these different groups, but there's greater risk associated with stand-up and sniper in terms of mm-hmm. offending. So just to pause for a second. So Scott, what are you?
Well, I think I'm a sweetheart.
Oh, you for sure a sweetheart.
I don't think that those three words have ever come out of my mouth in that order.
you're definitely a sweetheart. You're correct. You got 84% on that test.
Yay, 84.3. No, like round 84, round. I do kind of, it probably is. But then, you know, if I ever do stand up, it might be more sniper. You know, who knows what persona I'll take on, you know, for fun. Okay, so now I want to just step back a second and just, how do you two know each other? Let's do like the origin story of this book. Our audience loves hearing that kind of stuff.
Okay, so the origin story of the book. Is that I had invited Naomi in to guest lecture in a Power of Story class that I was teaching. And the idea was for her to bring in her past research from Deloitte and other places to talk about how data and story are integrated in order to persuade, to bond teams, to feel empathy, to lead, etc. So I'm watching Naomi guest lecture in the back of the classroom, as you do, and I'm watching all of the students, and they're dying laughing for an hour and a half while she's talking about, you know, eigenvalue analysis and neurochemistry. And so it was highly analytical, and yet they were laughing the whole time. So I thought that was weird, but I thought it was more weird when 10 weeks later I did ratings and she scored off the charts. And the way in which she taught
made it so that the students, they didn't just enjoy it, they actually learned a lot more than, you know, had they not been laughing. So that got me really intrigued by these properties of, you know, what does humor do? When does it allow you to encode information differently? When is information seen more differentiated? Can it be more memorable if it's learned with humor? And then we ended up talking that evening, just a degree of how did the class go? And we went into all sorts of areas of research that we both found to be incredibly fascinating. And then we were kind of on the humor journey.
I love that. I love that. Did you guys, like, early on in your friendship, like, laugh a lot together?
Well, Naomi is hilarious, and I am not. So
that's not true. Jennifer is hilarious.
Speaking, she went downhill and I went uphill. No, I mean, I think that, yeah, it's been actually, when you put humor at the basis of a common, you know, area of interest or passion, and that actually fuels the relationship, I think it does. It breathes, you know, it becomes infectious. It becomes a property of the relationship. So I would say that that's true. And one of the things that's, you know, sort of most, I don't know, surprising about writing this book and having taught this class with Naomi for the last 6 years is that the cultures around us also become, you know, more laughter filled, more generous with their laughter. They actually, the people around us seem to value it more.
Yeah. I mean, there's a way in which we have to live out what we're teaching. And if we're not, then we're obviously really doing something wrong. So I remember when we were writing the proposal for this book, and it felt like so much pressure to put down the perfect proposal on paper, or even to write a book, felt like just kind of a, you know, a big undertaking, which I recognize you won't identify with because you're like, books, crank them out. But I had personally never written a book. And so we were going to start this document and we realized that we were holding so much tension about it, that it was feeling stressful. And so we titled the document A Really Shitty Proposal. That's what we titled it.
What a great book title.
A Really Shitty Proposal.
We kept it on the book for like 2 years until it was almost published.
Yeah. It became what we were doing. So when we even submitted it to the publishers as A Really Shitty Proposal. And then when we started writing the book, we titled it A Really Shitty Book, A Really Shitty Chapter One. Are we allowed to say this much on your podcast? Yes, but it was this way of reminding us, right? In everything we're doing, we're reminded that we're here to do really serious work. We're here to do a good job. And we're also here to not take it so seriously and laugh along the way.
I love that. And you talk about like the bottom line value of humor, you know, and could you elaborate a little bit? Could one of you elaborate a little more on what that means?
Sure. One thing that's really interesting is that, you know, because, and later Naomi should share like her personal story about, you know, what she was doing before this. But one thing we find is that most people don't believe they can bring humor to work. You know, you probably laugh or use it on the weekends, but you don't really use it more generally. And in fact, there's a lot of data to back that up. One large-scale Gallup study of 1.4 million people, over 166 countries were involved. These subjects were asked a simple question. Did you smile or laugh yesterday? And the answer is yes when you're 16, 18, 20. And then all of a sudden at 23, it plummets. The effect size is gigantic. And it doesn't start to increase until you're retired. So like 70 and 80, it starts to increase a little bit. So what's happening is we go to work and we stop smiling and laughing. But what's fascinating is if you start to look at the actual hard data that suggests the benefits are there, you start to wonder, you know, what's going on. For one, you know, work by Brad Bitterly and Allison Woods Brooks and Maurice Schweitzer shows that when individuals are seen as having a sense of humor, and it doesn't even have to be a good sense of humor, just a sense of humor, that they're about 37% more respected, so they have higher levels of status, and they're seen as more competent and confident. In another set of studies, managers who were seen as having a sense of humor, which is different than being funny. So these aren't people that were saying like, you know, the manager is funny. It was just had a sense of humor, were 27% more motivating and admired by their employees. And the employees were about 15% more engaged and satisfied in their work. Teams that reported under these types of leaders report to be twice as creative. And not only that, but there's these mental health benefits that you know so well, right? Which are so important, especially right now. So for example, there was one large scale Norwegian study that looked over the course of 15 years of people that said they had a sense of humor. Again, it doesn't have to be even a good sense of humor. It was in Norway. And nothing against Norwegians. I'm Norwegian, so I love the Norwegians. But like, you know, keen sense of humor. I'm not sure if it's up there. I'm going to blame my DNA. Anyway, what they found was that individuals with a sense of humor lived on average 8 years longer than those who said they didn't. 8 years longer. And remember, Scott, those are high quality funny years because you're finally starting to climb back out of the humor abyss. In that same study, the researchers found that individuals with a sense of humor were 30% more resistant to severe disease. So when you think about the actual ROI on this or the bottom line value of humor, especially in the workforce, it's significant.
Yeah, you opened my eyes, you know, up big time when I was reading your book about the humor cliff, which is what you just described, and you call it the humor cliff in the book. And you know, it's a bit depressing. I gotta admit, I was like, oh, this is really not good. 23. Right. I mean, we already had the bad news that intelligence starts to decline at 19, but now humor declines too. I'm like, what do we got? You know, that was really sad. But you know, have you thought about like interventions in like universities? You know, to like infuse more humor into the classroom, for instance? Like, I mean, obviously you embody that and live that with the work you do, but what about all around the country? You know, not everyone's doing the kind of work you two are doing, right? You know, what sort of like system-wide level interventions or things, you know, can be done to raise the tide for all society?
I think in part it's, oh, go ahead, Jennifer.
No, I was going to say, that was a great question, which Naomi will take.
Thank you.
So
that's funny.
I think in part it's building awareness. I also, you know, my background is more in the corporate space. So I think about how do we bring this to groups of executives who are getting together for a board retreat or have their executive team offsite where they only get together once a year. They need to accomplish a ton and they are not thinking about how do we get together and laugh. And in that context, because my work outside of teaching previously has been designing and facilitating these sessions for groups of executives. How do you get to breakthrough? How do you get 30 people to have a breakthrough in 8 hours? And in that context, I find that the most effective interventions are ones that are subtle and that allow invitations for play. So I'll give you an example. I facilitated an offsite for the board of a $2 billion utility. And it was, they were coming together to do a wargaming simulation. So everyone, so for those who don't know what a wargaming simulation is, it's essentially a bunch of executives get in the room and they say, they take on the persona of their biggest competitors and then they try and tear down the company. So it's sort of, it's role-playing for executives and also less fun than any other type of role-playing you might be thinking of. All right, so they get into these roles. And what we did was we had little costumes at every breakout group. So the Silicon Valley, you know, utility nerds had these red hoodies that they could put on. And another group had, you know, granola bars because they were really environmental. They had granola bars and bucket hats and like fishing poles, right? So just these sort of silly, lighthearted things. But what we found was, you know, people get to the breakout group, they start putting on their hoodies and a shift happens where they start sort of joking around with each other. Someone reaches over and pulls back someone else's hoodie. And it shifts the dynamic and it unlocks a more playful side. And similarly, when we do our report outs, instead of having people raise their hands if they have a good idea, or if you hear something that's really insightful that you think we need to incorporate into our strategy, we passed out cowbells and kazoos, right? So you have this, you know, all these CEOs of different companies that take themselves very seriously, and their only way to communicate that they agree is to ring a cowbell or to buzz a kazoo, right? And it just shifts. It shifts the way that we are able to bring a fuller range of ourselves and we're invited to play.
are there like individual differences in responsiveness to that kind of intervention? You know, there's obviously the obvious, like the grump, you know, who's just like, bah humbug, I'm not going to laugh if you make me. But then I feel like there's also another type that I wanted to talk about in that might respond to that kind of thing in a different way, because they're almost like humorless. And the people that I have observed, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this because it's just an observation, I haven't done research on it, but it appears to me like people who are like profoundly narcissistic, you know, like psychopaths, or even, don't seem to have much of a sense of a humor. Like, and if so, and they can't seem to mock them, they can't seem to bring themselves to even view themselves in a funny light at in any moment. You know, there's not a lot of self-deprecation there. And people who aren't capable of self-deprecation, in my observation, don't tend to be very joyous people at all. And I don't know, is there any truth to this? Have you done any research on that?
We haven't done any research on this, but it's such an interesting observation, right? It's that what, you know, how do you define humor? Is it an ability to self-reflect? Is it a propensity to, you know, have self-deprecating jokes as an opportunity to actually, you know, bond or diffuse tension sort of in a room? You know, the way that we think about humor is that, you know, there's these very different types of humor. And so instead of thinking about this as like you're either humorful, I guess, or humorless, we think about it in terms of these different types, you know, just thinking, you know, even like in the early days of personality, right? When Big Five came out and we started thinking like, you either have a personality or you have no personality, which by the way, one of the worst things you could ever tell someone is that A, they don't have a personality, or B, they're humorless. So I think they're both kind of up there as like a pretty brutal comment. Anyway, you know, we love good typologies, right, Scott? And so I think one of the reasons we like good typologies is because it dimensionalizes a construct that hasn't really been unearthed. It hasn't really been exploited or understood. And one thing that, you know, people, when, you know, even in the class, when they think of this class, they think, oh, that's going to be this, you know, non-rigorous, you know, kind of like, you know, sort of silly type of course, but it's highly rigorous. You know, what we're trying to do is really debunk perceptions of what humor is. It's not about being funny. It's definitely not about trying to be funny. It's about cultivating joy. The students actually do end up, you know, getting funnier at the end of the class, but that's not the goal. The goal is to sort of look at life in these really interesting ways and borrow secrets from comedians in order to sort of observe life in a sort of a different way. And then as you observe life, not necessarily just looking for funny things, but just like kind of interesting, huh, kind of things, then you can use these tools from comedians like exaggeration or contrast or rule of three in pretty systematic ways that allow you to actually be able to make others laugh. And it's almost like math. So Naomi, do you want to give like one example?
Sure. So a rule of three example would be, and what if we said, okay, I'm trying to use something that we've said earlier. So you could say, one thing that is great about us all doing this video conference is, rather than, you know, doing it in person is, you know, we can be back to back from another meeting. You know, we don't have to make our hair look as good because we have virtual backgrounds. And we only have to get dressed on 84% of our bodies. Right? So
that's the magic number today, 84%.
Which implies that I'm maybe not wearing pants. And also makes a callback to what we've said earlier, which is we've said 84% a couple times. So what that does is rule of three is where we do something that's a little bit unexpected on the third element. And I also use the callback, which is where if there's anything that we've said earlier that we've laughed about, the simplest way to get another laugh is just to refer back to that number. Now, that was an objectively horrible joke, and I wasn't quite ready to make it.
Sorry about that. But wait, one thing I will notice, first of all, that was outstanding, I thought. Second of all, you know, even like, even if the listener right now is going, this is not necessarily overly comical, but there's something that happens among the three of us.
Maybe comical, you know, because in a different way. But
yeah,
go on.
there is a bonding. And the idea is that the bar is so low, especially in the workplace, especially in remote work. And so just being able to read the room or understand when something lighthearted might actually help. And then having these rules, like rule of three, as Naomi said, or these callbacks, remembering when you or I or Naomi said something and kind of noting that down, that something that made everyone else laugh, and then referring back to that later in the meeting, something as risk-free as that is sufficient enough to actually change the tenor of the room.
Oh my gosh, 100%. You know, Pete, the bar is, I know you got a 100%.
Did you plan that? Oh my God.
I didn't plan that. No, but I was going to, when you said, you know, usually the bar is really low, I thought what you were going to say is for academics. because I was going to be like, you know, it's so true. Like if I go to like give a keynote or a talk or something, like they're expecting, you know, Professor Columbia, they're expecting me to be the opposite of funny. So if I even say like, you know, hello everyone, and then I trip and fall, they'll be like, oh my gosh, he's so funny. You know, like it's just, you know what I'm saying? Like the bar is so low for us.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
It's so true.
Business and too.
Completely. We have one friend who actually is a big keynote speaker, and he tapes all of his lectures, like his keynotes. And then he just notes down when people laughed. Because you don't remember, right? Like you trip and everyone laughed and you're like, you forget that immediately. Yeah. But anyway, so what he does, he's just, tapes a few of them, listens to them again and notes when people laugh. And then he just writes down a little signature story of what was it that made people laugh. The interesting thing about humor is that it's kind of like, you know, going to see your favorite band. When they play the favorite song, everyone is so happy. Similarly, when you have your signature story, your signature jokes, and you play them again, you often think, oh, no one's going to laugh. I've said this a million times. But that only happens in your house with your partner. Everyone else loves it. And so having that, you know, basically a signature story bank is an incredible asset for executives, for leaders, for anyone.
I love that. Professors, you know, like they should have it in the pocket, you know, when they're discussing complex arcane information, you know, and the students have fallen asleep.
Yeah. And the best professors do. I mean, that initial story I shared about Naomi, I think is illustrative, you know. Humor and intelligence and the ability to intake information and remember it, all of those things go together.
Yeah, and just want to circle back to Naomi for a second, because when you were giving your three things, I was like picking up a improv vibe from you, because I was like, I don't know, I can kind of do that with like, I'm like, oh, I bet they did UCB. And so anyway, I kind of got that vibe from you a little bit. Can you tell us a little about your experiences with UCB?
Yeah. Wait, first, what was your experience with UCB?
Oh, I loved it. My teacher was, her name was Betsy Stover. And she, it was in New York City, and I had to do like, you know, the end of the capstone, they have this capstone thing where you have to go on the stage and perform. And I just invited one friend, my best friend, because I trust him to never tell anyone about that, about what my stand up and improv experience there. But I personally actually, I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about yours. Like, you know.
So I for about 10 years was doing improv on my nights and weekends while I was doing, you know, business by day. And so, I love UCB, have trained at Upright Citizens Brigade, have, trained at BATS in San Francisco at the Second City. So I've, have sort of learned different methodologies. By the way, you said you invited one friend. I trained and performed at, in LA for 6 years. I was sort of splitting my time between San Francisco and LA. And I would never tell any of my friends when my shows were, because it just, for me, there is something so pure about improv and sort of doing it for the love of it, that I never wanted it to be something that was overly performative. Like I never wanted it to be about having people come see me. And as long as I was getting joy and getting fulfillment out of just doing it for the sake of doing it, then that's when I knew that I, you know, it was sort of the right thing to do. And then what happened was I had a moment at work where I had this realization that I was really leading a double life where by day I was perceived by my colleagues. Jennifer said that the worst thing you can be is personalityless and humorless. And that is exactly how I was being seen by my colleagues. I had a client one day tell me that she basically thought that I was a lonely cat lady who spent my weekends alone and, you know, just watched History Channel reruns by myself all weekend. And so it was, yes, it was rough. And so from that came this realization and belief that there just has to be a better way, that all of what I believe in so deeply outside of my work, that the power of humor, not just to have fun, but also to build meaningful relationships, to be resilient through some of the most challenging things in my life, to be more creative and sort of resourceful, that all of those things were actually things that we need more than ever right now in our professional lives as well, which of course set us, set me on this journey.
So you feel like you're more integrated now.
I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah, it was my single focus goal when I went to Stanford for business school, when I was a student there, to become a more integrated version of myself, which is part of why I went to work at IDEO. Cause I looked around and I was like, okay, who's doing this well? Who is bringing their full creative, weird selves to work in a way that's really encouraged? And it's also part of why I really was excited to partner with Jennifer, because I saw Jennifer tell stories of, you know, her kids around the dinner table and her life outside of teaching, where she was doing this work, you know, around Dragonfly and trying to have real impact in the world. And I thought, wow, these are people who, that is someone who feels fully integrated through her professional life and through her personal life. So yeah, that was a real goal.
Do you feel like your mental health improved? Because you do talk in your book about the link between humor and mental health. And did you personally feel a shift in that kind of consciousness?
I did. I really did, actually. I mean, when I was at the point in my career in consulting, when I had this realization, I felt really close to burnout. I knew that it wasn't a sustainable career path for me. And I thought that was because I maybe wasn't cut out for that work. By the way, I was doing great at work. I was in the highest ratings group among my peers. I was getting promoted, and I just felt like it was completely unsustainable. And the realization for me is it wasn't because the work wasn't right. I can make any work right if I'm able to be a more integrated version of myself, if I'm able to have fun and genuinely enjoy myself with my colleagues. And so as soon as that was removed, as soon as this persona of who I thought I needed to be was removed, then it was incredibly freeing. It's like, oh, I can actually do anything and be joyful while I'm doing it, which frees up all of these things I can do with my career.
Well, what a wonderful realization. You know, I try to create an environment with my podcast for every guest. I don't care who the guest is. I try to create a safe space for humor. I'll put it that way. So I hope you feel that safe space for humor here as well.
Totally.
So, and maybe I'll address Jennifer here because I don't want her to feel left out here in this conversation at all. But
it's fine, guys. Talk amongst yourselves. I'm just kidding.
Hilarious.
I was going to interject and go. And so in contrast, Naomi decided I need a career that's going to be much more sustainable. And so I said, I will write a book, which is totally sustainable and I will sleep all of the time.
I think I'm going to not sleep for 2 years, get paid little to nothing for doing it, and
possibly lose my health insurance, and then just hope to God it comes back someday magically.
You too, like, should do like a YouTube comedy like routine. I feel
like. This is just her last week. So anyway, this is not a routine, Scott.
Her last week? Life. This is her last week of what?
No, what we
wait,
just
Jennifer, is there something you don't know?
Wait, what do you mean? That you know this is our last week on Earth? What
this
do you
is
mean?
My last week. This is it.
I'm trying to understand.
Why didn't no one tell me?
And I think that's a good way to end the podcast. All right, folks.
No.
Good luck.
No.
Good luck out there.
Jennifer, what did you mean by that, Jennifer?
No, I was describing Naomi's last week, which was sleepless.
Oh, last, prior.
Barely
prior,
stressed. Prior. And she nearly lost, well, she did lose her health insurance, but we think it's back. So I was describing her last week.
Gotcha. If you guys want, I can die. I can submit for the show notes, Scott. I can submit just transcripts from my therapy sessions as well. Yeah. If you think. Because it seems like that's what the listeners want to hear.
they love authenticity. They love it. They love authenticity. There's an interesting relationship. Bring up a different topic from your book, because you had so many fascinating things in your book. Another thing that fascinated me in reading your book was talking about status and humor and how it's a very complicated relationship. And I've noticed that too. For instance, I'll tell you something I noticed, and please tell me how this whole relationship works. But I've noticed that in environments where there's like a higher powered person, like a boss or something, like everyone just like laughs at the person's jokes, even though they're stupid jokes. You know, like there's almost like you feel compelled to when someone has power over you. And it's always fascinating because I've always been the one that doesn't laugh, you know, and people are like, Scott, you should laugh. It's like, no, but this person's not funny, you know. So, but that's where I get in trouble, is maybe I'm too honest sometimes. But I've noticed that phenomenon. It's a fascinating phenomenon. So anyway, please tell me, what your research says on this.
Absolutely. So a couple things. One, you're completely right. When you increase the concern about humor is that as you increase in status, that you still might get significant laughs when you try, any laugh line, but you don't know why people are laughing. And so there's, what Scott, is kind of a Duchenne laughter or Duchenne smile. And so you have to get, as you increase in status, you have to really understand what's authentic. Exactly. What's authentic laughter, and be able to read the room with emotional intelligence that's potentially even more important than when you are lower levels of status. The other thing that we find is that as you increase in status, you are often more free to use self-deprecation and not have it harm you. And this is particularly important if you look at humor through a gender lens. As one small example, we find that some of the female executives that we either have data on or have worked with, they tend to be magnets or sweethearts to a greater degree. Again, not a huge effect size, but it definitely is there. And then male executives tend to lean towards stand-up and sniper. So as Naomi said, oftentimes stand-ups and snipers often tease or have a zinger. And partly because sometimes it's just a sign of affection. Like if I tease you, it means I like you. But imagine you're in a room with a variety of people. You can imagine how easily you can offend. And similarly, for our females, they tend to over-index on self-deprecation, partly because as a magnet or a sweetheart, you're trying to uplift others oftentimes, right? Yeah. And so at lower levels of status, that's really, suboptimal for one's career. However, as you move up in the hierarchy and you increase levels of status, that's where self-deprecation can be this incredible tool. And you said people really, used to be that leaders needed to be revered. We wanted to be, hold our leaders in respect. And now leaders need to be understood. And so that's why authenticity or like, what are you, really like has become so important. And self-deprecating humor is an incredible tool to reveal that.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. And I guess like it depends. There's an interaction there, right? Like if you're lower status and you're self-deprecating, that's not perceived the same way as a higher status person being self-deprecating. If you're a higher status person being self-deprecating, I think that person gets respect in a way. It's like, oh, respect. Like that person is not abusing their power in a way. You know, they can still be the laugh of their own jokes. Whereas I personally, my heart breaks sometimes when I see a lower status person being self-deprecating. I don't know why it hurts me sometimes. Like I'll see like someone with a disability who does stand up and their whole shtick is making fun of themselves and their disability. And I know it's supposed to be funny and maybe it's empowering for that person, in some way. But for me, it almost hurts to watch it. I don't know if I'm the only one.
No, I think it's such a good point. I think I know exactly what you're saying. And I think that the one thing that's really interesting about self-deprecation is, you know, this degree to which I think it's Hannah Gatsby. You had a great show, and she talked exactly about this very point. Like, I'm not going to self-deprecate, and it was this incredible power to arms, especially for, you know, females, I think, but maybe, you know, just in general, just like saying, like, I'm not going to do that. That said, some of my personal favorite humor is self-deprecation, especially among people that I don't necessarily know. And the reason is because it's the fastest way I've found to close the distance between two people. So if I have a set of people that really don't know me, and maybe, you know, they see that really long bio and they go, that person must be important. And so it's hard to actually have a conversation or be able to engage with ideas. And you do one self-deprecating joke, which is, you know, why we teach the students to use a levity line in their bio. For me, it's that she won, you know, a dance off in the 1980s. Obviously, that's not meant to be like something I'm really proud of, but something that people can kind of tease me about and invite me to dance and see exactly how bad I am now, et cetera. And so that ability to have self-deprecation, you know, close the distance between two people is really powerful.
Yeah.
Naomi is interesting because she also actually moves across different styles seamlessly. So that's also been kind of interesting to watch.
Oh, that's interesting. She's a humor chameleon.
A humor chameleon, As we can all be, actually. And it's exactly because of that, because humor, we code humor with all of, we put so much like subconscious processing into how we interpret humor. And so there's this, we interviewed a whole bunch of comedians, and one of the things that we loved was this idea that humor exists in the space between the comedian and the audience, because it is part of the relationship and part of the dynamic. So as one example, there's a principle in comedy, never punch down. And that means you never want the target of your humor to be someone of lower status than you. And so this, of course, this rule makes it very obvious why, as you get more senior in an organization, your playing field gets narrower and narrower, because everyone is getting, you know, lower status. And
darn you, God, the only way you can, the only person you could punch up to is God.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why the butt of every joke really should be God. But there's this other idea, which is, we need to switch our style based on the context. So, so again, from my personal experience, relatively early in my career, I was in my late 20s, I was designing and facilitating these workshops. So I was at the front of the room, leading people through exercises who were mostly 20 years my senior and predominantly more male than me, right? So there is an intrinsic status dynamic that's going on there. And in that context, sniper and stand-up humor were extremely powerful for me. That if someone made a you know, an offhand comment, and I shot it down immediately with sort of a quick one-liner. I remember, and I wrote this in the book, but that guy Craig, who you know, he made sort of an offhand comment, like, what, I was designing a session, or I was leading a session with him, and he said, you know, when are you going to cut to the chase and tell me how to just get my people to do what I want them to do? And it was really uncomfortable. Everyone sort of froze. And I shot back immediately. That's a great question, Craig. You're thinking about the session that I run on mind control. And that one is actually next week. So come on back. We can go over mind control then. And it just changed the dynamic, right? Everyone laughed. Even Craig laughed. He said, word for word, I respect you. You can continue. And so in that context, that style is really powerful. However, then when I'm in the classroom teaching, and, you know, Jennifer and I were at the front of the room, and we are, quote, the highest status people in that role that we're in, right, relative to our students, that type of humor will not fly I need to use sweetheart humor. I need to use magnet humor. And in fact, and Jennifer knows this, in the first couple weeks of teaching, I used a sniper-like comment, and it was like completely fell flat. It felt like I had kicked one of the students' puppies. And I very quickly was reminded, oh yeah, I'm in a very different status role here than I am in my other context. And I better be aware of that and shift.
It's wonderful context. Jennifer, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I thought it was perfect.
You know,
100%.
Oh, 100%. Yay. We're all at 100% now. The
thing I was going to add to that is that also invites, when you are able to be playful with each other, like Jennifer and I, when we teach together, we are like, we're constantly making fun of each other, or Jennifer will have like a very impressive presentation and I'll put a random slide in the middle of the presentation that's like her dog with a graph that says like, you know, growth. And Jennifer has to speak to that chart. Like she has to get to it and be like, oh, and you know, next time talking about growth. It's just a way to invite our students to be playful, and which then they end up doing pranks on us, which is really a lot of fun.
Oh, I would love to hear an example of like one prank, but you don't have to tell me.
Jennifer, do you want to share or should I share? One prank was our students had on the second to last day of class, they had filled up all these water balloons, and apparently they worked with our co-lecturer, Connor Demon-Yaman, and so they knew the exact phrase that Connor, a question that he was going to ask us. And so Jennifer and I are at the front of the room, we're lecturing, and then we said that phrase, and every like 45 students pull out water balloons and start throwing them at us.
What?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could catch pneumonia. I feel like a mother all of a sudden.
Oh my gosh, you're such a sweetheart. We will show you a video clip. It is highly comical, and we did not catch pneumonia.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. I always worry about getting wet in public. Anyway, you talk in your book about the biological basis of humor, and I was just trying to reconcile, when you talk about that, reconcile that with culture, the existence of cultural differences. And clearly in some cultures, there are some things that shall not be joked about, right? They're more sacred than other cultures. It's important, by the way, to know that. So you don't go to a culture and give a keynote in, you know, in India and happen to make a joke that's like off limits in India, you know, or something like that. But does that mean that still biologically, even though something may be off limits culturally, people are still responding the same way? I don't know if I'm articulating my question in a way that is amenable to an answer, but I am curious in that interplay between the existence of cultural differences, but there also being kind of a universal biological basis to humor receptivity. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. I mean, laughter is universal. What we find is when people laugh together, you know, there's a cocktail of healthy hormones that are released. So increased levels of endorphins, decreased levels of cortisol, increased levels of oxytocin, which, you know, is a hormone that you experience, you know, in childbirth or sex. And so this entire cocktail of emotions is something that's quite universal. Naomi has this great line that we love so much, which is, you know, exercise and meditation and having sex, that's basically all three of those things together is the same thing as laughter. So it's like, it's definitely a multiplier. Anyway, that is a universal thing. What makes people laugh, what they find funny, to your point, is obviously different. So one thing that we find in our data is, you know, sweethearts, for example, tend to correlate with interdependent cultures. So oftentimes in, you know, the risk of hurting others' feelings, especially, depending on in-group, out-group group status, you know, that would be like the worst thing to do. And so if you put that at a premium, you're going to over-index on, you know, sort of sweethearts or potentially magnets, depending on whether they're introverted or extroverted. But, you know, what's going to be important is making sure you're not hurting or risking offending others. Mm-hmm. In other cultures, you know, for example, you know, in Russia, there's less of a desire to have everything always be kind of necessarily happy. You know, Sonia Lyubomirsky's work, for example, a while ago, and that looked at, you know, the propensity. Only Americans really want to have, like, you know, the story have, you know, a happy ending, for example. In that similar way, that notion of, you know, the magnet that really always uplifts others, that, you know, you would hypothesize would not be necessarily, you know, as common in certain cultures that don't enforce it. So I think the thing that's interesting to test is that the humor types people have and what people laugh at would be related to the values that the culture has and the norms that they impose.
So in America, what kind of jokes typically get the most positive reactions?
It's a really good question. We have a small anecdote. I don't have an empirical answer. Maybe Naomi does, but I don't. But one thing that was interesting, and this was anecdotal, but in one of our classes, we had a student that was from Singapore, and he brought basically comedy clips from Singapore into the class. On the last day of class, he talks a little bit about what actually, you know, people laugh at. And one of the things that he talked about was this whole idea of don't punch down isn't necessarily this universal kind of thing. And so there was a lot of, like, punching down in some of the clips that he showed by very popular comedians. And it was interesting to think about, you know, what was the different meaning in that. I would say in America, though, that the kind of common belief that you don't want to punch down, that you want to laugh at life to a greater degree, or you want to, like, be self-deprecating, at least anecdotally, that seems to be true. What do you think, Naomi?
Yeah, I think, I think that humor is such an interesting mirror to the values of a society. Yeah. And in some ways, so Ann Libra, who is the director of comedy. Okay, great. Yeah.
I love her.
Ann Libra talks about these three elements of humor: truth, pain, and distance. And pain could be anything from stubbing your toe to a real taboo topic in society. Humor, in some ways, pushes on the edge of our cultural boundaries. And so if you look at what SNL, Saturday Night Live, is joking about today versus what Saturday Night Live was joking about 10 years ago, or if you look at similar shows in other countries and what they're joking about, you get a sense of what is the shape of appropriateness for that culture, because humor pushes on those boundaries. Humor pushes on, like, tiptoes over the line of appropriateness and can get away with it because it's cloaked in humor. And so I think my broader observation about humor is that it is a deep reflection of a society. And so, and there's a quote that I'm going to butcher, so I'm not going to try it, but it's basically, when you change cultures and you change languages, the first thing to go is your sense of humor, because you're totally blind to what are the nuances of this culture, what are the inside references that we as a society know, and you just lose all of that. And so you're sort of floating blind, and all you can do is just poke at whatever elements of shared experience are universal to the human experience rather than are unique to that culture. So that would be sort of my broader view on why humor is so interesting when not just as a way of us having fun together, but as a way of deeply understanding, Scott, what is your truth about the world? And what is our truth about America, and what is, you know, other cultures' truths about about their experience of the world?
Do you think there should be moral codes for comedy or moral rules? You know, I saw a Dave Chappelle bit, and he was punching down at trans people, and the audience found it absolutely hilarious, and I assume many trans people did not find it so funny. And they were, you know, a large part of the trans community went on Twitter and said, like, cancel Dave Chappelle. You know, he shouldn't be able to have the microphone. And I think it raises interesting questions, you know, like, you know, does a society want to condone certain types of humor? Should the trans people who were offended by that lightened up, just lightened? Do you know what I mean? And it's so many interesting questions about this. I don't have the answers. I'm just want to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I have a thought. You go.
You go.
No, you go if you want. I was. Please edit this out, Scott.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. No. Yeah.
Jennifer, would you like, or would you like me to go?
Okay, I can go. I was just going to talk about workplace.
I'm keeping that in, by the way.
No,
that was funny. No, you take that one. No, you. I'm not taking that one. You did.
I'll take it. I'll die on the sword.
You know what? You know what dynamic Jennifer and I don't have is I'll go. No, I'll go. I want this one. It's always like, no. Would you like to go? Please.
No, you go. You go first.
Jennifer, you go.
Okay. God, way to take control, Scott. All right, so I think what we do, at least in our class, which is very different than, you know, if you're actually on stage, is we talk a lot about this idea of, like, just joking. You know, if your point is that someone's less good than you or different than you, even if it's arguably the point, it's not worth saying. You know, if you have to explain that you were just joking, you've already lost. It doesn't matter if your favorite comedian, like Dave Chappelle, gets away with it. So I'm not talking necessarily about that. I'm talking about more about what we try and do in the classroom and how we talk a little bit about it. It's that, you know, your workplace is not one of those spaces. Now, you could argue when you enter a comedy club that there are a different set of norms than, you know, when you're in the workplace or the classroom, et cetera. And there's a common understanding of what we're doing in this place is we're going to poke fun at this. And, you know, Kelly Leonard and Ann Libera talk about this as well, right? Is that your job, you know, to reveal humor in a situation is to do some poking around. And there'll be times where you actually cross boundaries. And the job there is to be able to have, you know, created this environment where people know the norms and there is an openness. One way that we try and simulate that type of environment in our classroom is with an exercise that Connor DeMignon, who teaches with us, helped to create. He called it the spectrum exercise. And so the way you do it is all the students line up on an appropriate to inappropriate dimension. So like half the students are kind of over on the right-hand side of the classroom, the other half are on the left, and you show them one particular tweet or joke or comedy sketch, et cetera. And you ask them to go where on that spectrum they believe that joke was, you know, in terms of appropriateness, right? So let's say that you thought Dave Chappelle's joke was highly inappropriate. You would go, you know, to the anchor of inappropriateness next to the whiteboard there. And then people on the extreme sides are asked to discuss their viewpoint. Why did you think it was inappropriate? Why did you think it was appropriate? And then because you're supposed to listen in a very open-minded way, it's a very inclusive environment, the next step is to really move. See if you are persuaded, see if you are open-minded. So it's based on these things of stay open, you know, don't judge in a way that's like, you know, claimed, and then allow other opinions to be heard. And then there's a real celebration for people shifting their perspective. And I think that, you know, that type of activity actually allows there to be not its censorship per se, but an open dialogue of why exactly that was inappropriate and an openness to moving your perspective. And I think that's what we need in the world right now, right? We need individuals to be more open-minded to hearing very different opinions about what is appropriate or not. This is the least funny podcast you've ever done. And yes, moral code. Okay. Okay, before we close, Scott, we do need to talk a little bit about, I would really love that point that Naomi brought up about truth, because at the core of comedy, as you know, is truth and misdirection. So if people, you know, all over the world can kind of all understand this is the truth, then just better understanding, you know, what does misdirection mean? Or how do you use these tools from comedians to better understand how to make others laugh and how to laugh with them? When people laugh with each other, they feel 30% closer and are more open to disclosing information about themselves. And yeah, you know, people that even reminisce about shared laughter versus just shared happiness tend to say that they're 23% more satisfied in their relationships. So this stuff is really, really potent and powerful. So one of my favorite tools after, you know, the truth is thinking about misdirection or even just like putting in a lighthearted line. So one of our favorite studies is where people came into the lab and it was a negotiations study. And there was a Confederate, an RA in the lab, and they either ended a negotiation with like, this is my final offer, or this is my final offer and I'll throw in a pet frog. And those individuals in that second condition received 18% more money. So basically they were richer because of a 6-word little laugh line that wasn't even good. Right. But it indicated, you know, that the person had a sense of humor and a sense of humanity, and that's enough to really shift things. And it has a very concrete ROI.
And well, oh my gosh, what is happening?
That's the best looking hat we have ever.
Do you guys like my new hat?
Oh my gosh. Love that hat.
I'm sorry. Love that. Technical difficulties. We just had technical difficulties. Naomi, would you, on that note, on us trying to end on a humorous ending, Naomi, would you like to have the last word?
Oh my gosh, I always love the last word. What I want to point out is how easy what Jennifer just said is. So we think of humor as being this incredibly hard thing, but it is just naming what's true. So right before Jennifer gave you that answer, she gave this whole line of thinking around the risks of humor and the downside. And she talked about the spectrum exercise that we do with our students. And then at the end of that answer, she said, isn't this the least funny podcast you've ever done or something like that, right? And what she was doing was naming the truth that we're all here to talk about humor. And yet, shockingly, it's actually a serious conversation because there's a lot of research underneath this, right? And so, but it was this great moment where all she needed to do was acknowledge the little bit of tension that she was feeling, which was, oh my gosh, we're here to talk about humor, and yet we're having a serious conversation about it. You notice that, you name it, and it's just the easiest way to get a laugh. And so as you're thinking about how do you have more humor in your life, just ask yourself, what's true? What's going on for me right now? What is weighing on me? What am I irrationally excited about? And it's those places where we're going to be able to unlock more humor, both with ourselves and how we view the world, but also with the people around us.
I love that. I think that it was a serious conversation, but the word that sticks in my mind more about today's conversation is that it was an important conversation. And I think that you two are shining a really important spotlight. And there's a time and place to be funny, and you two can be very funny, trust me. But I'm glad you came on here and you could have this important conversation with me today. So thank you.
100%.
84%. Thank you. 100%.
99.8.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, guys. Scott. Thanks, guys.
Next time, we'll all wear our matching hats.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.